You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
To the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is one of the leading experts, I would say, on the current state of our politics, the hyper-partisanship red-blue divide, and the appeal of Donald Trump to working-class voters. She's Arlie Russell Hochschild. She was my guest several years back on a fascinating book she wrote called Strangers in Their Own Land, where she went down and lived among working class voters down in Louisiana. And she's back with another book. It's called Stolen Pride, Lost Shame and the Rise of the Right. And it's very timely with this critical election we face here in about a month. Arlie, thank you so much for taking the time to be back today.
Well, I'm just really very happy to be here.
So where did your travels take you this time, and why, where did you wind up and why?
Yeah, well, I wound up in Pikeville in Pike County in what is the whitest and second poorest congressional district, Rogers District in the United States. And I got there kind of by a fluke. I got after Strangers in Their Own Land, I was kind of feeling discouraged about the big partisan divide. And I got a telephone call from a guy named Ro Khanna, who's a Democratic congressman, represents Silicon Valley in California. And I wondered why he'd called. Well, it was because he had crossed the aisle to make a deal with Hal Rogers of Paintsville, Kentucky, who represents unemployed coal miners in a rural area, a Republican area. So you had a Democrat, Republican in different areas. One, the Democratic, Ro Khanna had a lot of jobs in mind, coding cell phones, apps for cell phones. And of course, Hal Rogers had a lot of unemployed people, really bright, technically oriented, who needed work. And so they got together and established what they fondly called Silicon Holler. So, and Ro asked me, would you be interested in looking at this? I said, when can I come? Good news, finally. So I went to Louisville to interview the students who had come for this six-month training program, and met them from Eastern Kentucky, come from very low-wage area, and happy to have this project funded by the Appalachian Regional Commission. And I went with them back to their homes. And that's what got me into Eastern Kentucky and got me into what was going on there 7 years ago.
Yeah, well, you take this is an interesting angle. And I've been reading a lot. This has been a central focus of my show in the 10 years I've been on. Is this divide in politics, and especially the working class, because our area has been hit by job loss, manufacturing job loss, et cetera. But you sat down and spoke with a lot of people and listened and had some fascinating takeaways, which we'll talk about. But, it used to be, and remember in 1992, James Carville had the sign in the Clinton campaign office, it's the economy, stupid. People voted their pocketbooks. After reading your work and really thinking about this more, people don't vote the economy anymore, do they?
No, it's the emotions, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I People care, of course, desperately about the economy. It's not to say that isn't there. It's just to say that that's not all. And in fact, excuse me, let me just get a glass of water. If we look at the 4 years Donald Trump was president, and from 16 to 20, and you look at Congressional District Kentucky 5, nothing economic changed. There was no help. Coal jobs did not come back. Better high-paid jobs did not come in. The Trump tax cuts did not help the second poorest area in the country. So, it's not economic gain that was at issue here. But what I think Donald Trump did offer is a sense of recognizing the stresses of economic loss and offering pride. I think that was, in a way, the ore that he was prospecting and found, and the fuel that he ignited was shame, structurally caused shame for a people who were very proud and had a culture of individual pride. They fit what I call a pride paradox. They're facing economic loss. Jobs are going out in a one kind of job area. It wasn't diverse. You lose job in one industry, you could go to another. No, it was loss. Either you stayed and worked a very low wage job, or you left. And people didn't want to leave. Economic hard times, but a culture of individualism that if you fail, that's on you. You didn't work hard enough. So people were structurally shamed, didn't know what to do about it. And he, I think, was the shame president. I think he's a shamed guy. He's very allergic to shame. He never apologizes, never does anything wrong. And that it gave him a certain sensitivity to the terrors and the pain of shame and anger at it. And I think that's the fuel that's gotten ignited here.
Sure did. I looked up, and you have this in the book. John Kerry in 2004 carried Pike County, Kentucky, but Trump got around 80% of the vote in the last two elections, and I mean, he'll probably do the same here in about a month. I couldn't help but notice that, and you're a sociologist. This is what you're an expert professional in, but I couldn't help but notice. The men you spoke with had a pattern of coming from broken homes, for the most part. Is that something you were aware of or think about that the and I'm not going to paint a broad brush and say all of them get into the more negative aspects of this far right extremism. They don't, not all of them, but it did seem like that was a pattern there.
There is, we talk about economic loss, but we don't talk about the whole social logic that goes with it. It's not just an individual thing, but in general, family connections are less stable the further down the social class ladder we go. And that's an extra pain and an extra actually source of shame. So yes, a lot of broken homes. And This here, here's the thing. The three kinds of loss. One is loss of jobs. Another is loss of the value of what you do. People feel a devaluation. They're really good, as a miner, let's say. Really know the ins and outs of that tunnel, but that's of no use when your whole occupation when the mine closes. So people feel the pain of devaluation, even the moral qualities it took to do a dangerous job and take, perhaps get black lung. All of that sacrifice feels like even the sense of pride that you associated with what you did and the risks you took, that seemed gone in a way. And then there's the loss relative to the blue states where, things look easier and they look better. And you wonder why. So these three kinds of loss sort of are hard to take. And I think they are shaming, and that I'll give you an example that relates to what you're saying about marital separation. There's a guy who said, "I'll tell you how loss is connected to shame." A guy loses his job, and his wife says, "The kids need, I need money for food." And he says, okay, but he doesn't want to take a 950 an hour job, a quote, girly job. And but he does anyway, though he takes a hit in shame. And she says there's still not enough money. He feels bad. And then he doesn't want to leave, though. He doesn't know anybody. He doesn't have the money. He doesn't have contacts in Cincinnati. But he goes anyway. Okay. But then he comes back empty-handed. And there's another source of shame. And then he gets into drugs. That can happen. People get depressed and vulnerable. And this was, they were targeted. By Big Pharma, the Sacklers. And that's another, this guy's telling me, he said, well, take it from me. They're ashamed about that. And then he loses his family. He gets divorced. He loses custody of his children. And then he's feeling all shamed. And then this man said, but by then he's forgotten about the shame. He's just pissing mad. And I think that was really a wonderful description of what downward mobility does. And so, yeah, there are a lot of broken homes and sons and daughters growing up in them. A lot of people are kind of second generation distress. And their dad was not an ideal dad. There are those who said that actually the appeal of Trump is he's just like that. He's a bad dad. He's just abusive. I love you, kid. And then he slaps you across the face, sort of. Oh, yeah, that's dad. And then Tim Walz is the good dad. He's not only taking care of you, but he's looking out for the kids on the block. So the kind of family you come from certainly enters into politics.
You're listening
It
to
isn't
Heartland.
just economics, yeah, or it's indirectly economic.
Excuse me. You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Arlie Russell Hochschild. She's the author of a new book called Stolen Pride: Lost Shame and the Rise of the Right. It details her spending some time in Pike County, Kentucky, and just listening to people writing and taking a different angle here than what we've been hearing a lot about as to why working class voters have fallen in line for a guy like Donald Trump, a billionaire television star. And it's very interesting reading, and I recommend it to folks who, like me, are continually trying to get a better grip on today's politics and partisanship, hyperpartisanship in our country. This book takes place in an interesting historical fact that I wasn't aware of, relating to the march in Charlottesville, Virginia. Your story has is related to that. Can you share some of that with our listeners?
Yeah, so was focusing on Pikeville, Kentucky, and it's a gem of a little town. It really just beautiful, and in the valley surrounded by beautiful mountains, and it's struggling to bring in good jobs. And it does have a medical center. Thriving. And so there are other sources of jobs there. But what happened in 2017 was, seemed to me, a kind of formed a perfect storm. Coal jobs, the best jobs in town, are going out. An opiate crisis is coming in. And then a white nationalist march led by a neo-Nazi named Matthew Heimbach comes to town. So I thought, oh no, this is first you have the vulnerability of loss, and then you have this kind of cruel solution, a bad solution to real problems. And I thought, that's a perfect storm. Let me interview the leader of the march. Let me interview the town fathers who are trying to protect the place from harm, and the potential victims. So I interviewed an African American, a Holocaust survivor, an imam at a tiny mosque, potential victims, minorities in the area. And then interview people top to bottom, side to side. What do they think about that idea? What other better solutions are there to the real problems there are? So that's kind of the framework of the book. But no spoilers here. This is maybe a spoiler, but what happened is the white nationalist march, with 20 different extremist groups came to town, all looking fierce, black, and armed to the teeth. And the town didn't go for it. They said, those on our hills, our cemeteries, and they have our grandfathers who fought in World War II against Nazism, against the Germans. And we don't want that again. Here, we've got enough problems. So that was that salute. And the leader of this white nationalist march saw this, that all the leaders did, as a trial run to the larger, more fatal and destructive march in Charlottesville, Virginia, a few months later. So they said no to extremism in that guise, but they had committed to Donald Trump, who himself became increasingly, increasingly, increasingly extreme. He embraced the far right. He embraced, actually, had a neo-Nazi to lunch at Mar-a-Lago. He considers those who broke in January 6th in the US Capitol to be patriots. He plans to, offer to pay their legal bills and free them. So, in a way, they said no to extremism in one guise, but yes to extremism in another. And again, it's beyond economics exactly. It is the a playing on cultural versions of pride that is really what we need to understand. I think, we need to become bilingual. We need to read history and current events, both from the point of view of what they are saying cognitively, but also what they're saying emotionally.
It just and it seems like on both sides, what I hear is I think this is the case with certainly people I talk to on the Republican side. They see Trump's warts. They don't, a lot of people don't really care for him, but they can't bring themselves to vote for the other side. And I hear the same thing on the Democratic side. People may not be totally in love with Kamala Harris, but there's no way they can vote for Trump. That's just where we are. The negative partisanship takes over any other considerations there.
Yeah, I think the Democratic Party has made some mistakes, big mistakes, and non you know here's one guy I talked to, a wonderful young man who said, "Look, I'm trailer trash, okay?" I have talked like, and he said, "But I don't see any difference between the life I have lived and that of a school buddy of mine who actually grew up, was black and grew up in Detroit." He said, "What's the difference? He grew up poor. I grew up poor. He was surrounded by drugs. I was surrounded by drugs. He didn't get very far in school. I didn't get very far in school. You know, he has relatives who drug dealers were in prison. I do too. He depends on public assistance and scams it. Yeah, well, my family depended on public assistance, also scams it." So he said, "There's no difference between that black friend of mine and me. I'm white, except for the music. We have Kentucky twangy and tragic and string instrument. He's got rap." And I actually went on to talk to some other people and I asked them about music. And one guy said, "Oh, you haven't heard about hillbilly rap?" And I began to think that actually the musicians, the creative people there saw connections that the politicians were refusing on both sides.
That's interesting. Well, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes here. I want to give you plenty of time. I remember reading through this and I'm thinking, boy, where's this going? You feel bad reading the personal stories, but then, and this is a quote, you found some quote quietly inspiring models on how to move forward. What can you share a little bit about the path forward and the concept of the empathy bridge, and that provides a little hope here, maybe for us to get some commonality and start reaching out across this divide?
Yes. To begin with, actually, most people are more moderate than our leaders. We should remember that. Most people are more in the middle and not as extreme as people you're watching on on television. And in general, actually, liberals are worse at reaching out than conservatives are. They're more likely to say, "Well, if someone says something that I really disagree with, and will you cut off contact me?" They do it slightly more than conservatives do. Whites do it more than blacks. So there's a kind of a challenge here for us to move forward with empathy bridge buildings. And I found some wonderful bridge builders who, and some fit what I call an upper kind of tier of the bridge. That is, they had done well in life, given their goals. They wanted to reach out and give back and reach out, a sort of noblesse oblige bridge. And then there was a lower bridge of people who had actually hit bottom, like a recovering drug addict, had really suffered. And he was reaching out. He said, "I'm not afraid of shame. I've already been through it. You can't make me afraid of it." So, and he was reaching out to African-American drug recovering drug addicts in a beautiful way. So I felt that was the beyond shame bottom, sort of, you could call it the bottom tier of this empathy bridge. There are different pathways that, in other words, that make it likely that we feel safe to reach out. But I actually ended up feeling a lot of hope because I met some people that are really pioneering it for us, and we should follow their example.
That's a great way to close, because so many people I talk to are very concerned about what's going on and not seeing a path forward. And I'm glad your book had that, because that lends itself again to a recommendation for folks to go read this if you want to really think this through, because it's very well written. And I like your style of going and just listening to what people are saying without judging. I think that's important. The book, again, folks, is called Stolen Pride, Lost Shame, and the Rise of the Right. The author has been my guest today, Arlie Russell Hochschild. It's been a pleasure visiting with you. And there's a lot more in this book. We just touched on a little bit, but I highly recommend it. And again, Arlie, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you so much, Robin.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.